This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 9, Changing Cricket Culture. There's a lot about cultures in the news this week, what with the World Cup going on. So the team talk about how you can change, improve and develop cricket culture at whatever level that you're at. And we also answer a few questions. The first one is about pace versus line and length. Always an interesting discussion. And we go into a little bit of depth about the middle overs, limited over cricket if you're a spin bowler. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome again to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to coaching better cricket, to playing better cricket and to all-round better cricket, no matter where you are or no matter who you are. My name is David Hinchliffe. And this week, as pretty much every week, I'm joined by two very fine cricket coaches who are going to help me talk about cricket for the next half an hour or so. The first of which is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garras.
Hello, all.
And secondly, we have Sam Lavery, who is, of course, the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, normally we have a very long show, which I then edit down into 30 minutes and leave some amazing gold stuff on the floor every week. But we're a bit low on time this week, so we're going to crack straight on with the first topic in this week's show. And that is all to do with cultures in cricket teams. And the reason why this is on my mind at the moment is because I've started coaching at a new club. I went last night to see them at Nets for the first time and trying to find out a little bit more about the culture of the club. But it brought up a few questions for me, especially in mind, Gareth, of your article that you wrote about cultures in World Cups. And it got to be thinking, how easy is it to change cultures in cricket teams? And I guess you have quite a lot of experience with cultures in cricket team, Gareth, and both from the outside and from the inside. So what do you think about being able to change a culture that's negative or maintain a culture that's positive?
Well, in both cases, it takes a bit of time, to be honest. It's not something that is an instant fix. So, for example, trying to change a culture within a World Cup, I'd say, is nigh on impossible. And if you look at the England situation, and nobody's saying that their culture's not right, there's speculation about their culture at the moment, but that's all it is really, is speculation. My article last week is I'd like to see them having a little bit more fun, that fun often brings a bit of perspective, yeah. But I can't be critical of being the setup because I'm not inside it. But how do you change it in a short period of time? I think it's very difficult. I think it's something that has to be worked on over a longer period of time. It often takes people, if you look at the Liverpool, for example, as a football club, it took Brendan Rodgers a year and a half to get it somewhere right. Then it drops off for a little bit. And then if you stick true to your values, it picks up again, which is where they are now. It's exactly the same with the rugby cultures. You look at what Stuart Lancaster has done with the England rugby team and many others. You look at what Darren Lehman has done with the Australian cricket team. It's not an instant fix. He didn't come in and change it straight away. It's a gradual thing. So, yeah, good luck, David, on trying to shift the culture around. There's always things that you can shift in cultures, but be patient with it would be my advice to you.
Yeah, as always, there's a lot of people invested a lot of time and effort and in often cases money into a club or a team or anything to do with cricket. And it's, you have to respect that no matter what you think of their particular opinions about the way that the culture should be. So it's very important to bear that in mind, and I would never sort of go piling and going, you're doing it all wrong, let's change it all. And in any case, from what I've seen so far, most things seem to be pretty sound, so I might have an easy job. Lavers, have you ever had a situation where you've gone into a team and you feel like there are some cultural changes that you need to make?
Yeah, I think you rarely move into a job and everything's rosy and everything's exactly how you like it. But yeah, I've been in a couple of situations where probably with my cricket club, where they brought me in because they needed a shift in focus and shift in how they were going to have their cricketing culture based on the previous few years not being as successful as they liked. And the time that it takes to make these changes is very, very varied. Depends slightly on the people you've got in the side or the group, the support you've got in developing that culture, and also kind of the scale that you're working to. So if you're trying to change your culture throughout a school or develop it slightly or tweak it, which when I first arrived at the grammar school down in here in Portsmouth is something that I wanted to do, given that I'm working across a number of year groups, it's going to be a longer process than maybe just making a change with one team if someone was working with an individual team. But yeah, it's something I've had a little bit of experience of, and it's something that fortunately with the various roles I'm in, I've been in for a number of years now, and feel like we're getting into a position where we're starting to produce what we'd like, not only in terms of results, but we're starting to consistently go through the processes and people are taking more ownership of the way they go about things, which is what I'd like to see. So yes, it's something that I'm part way through probably, but whether or not you ever actually realise the ideal, I'm not sure.
Speaking of the ideal, I'm also interested in this idea about an underlying assumption, really, that if you've got a good culture, you will have good results. But is there necessarily a link between a good culture and good results, and a bad culture and bad results?
No, there's not. You can have a good culture that is working towards getting better results. So during that journey, you don't always win. And ultimately, cultures don't guarantee you points or guarantee you wins. They just give you the best chance of being able to review effectively, to be able to speak honestly about what you're doing, and to work in the right direction. That's all that they do. And we know enough about cricket, and we know enough about people and the variability that's involved in both of those to know that there's nothing guaranteed. And you've only got to look at the World Cup and some of the performances, some of the individual scores, some of the upsets that have happened in it, to realise that things don't always happen in a linear and a predictable fashion. And that's the great thing about sport, and it's a great thing about people. But what cultures, good cultures do, is it gives you a really good foundation from which good results are more likely to happen. You can only ever give yourself the best chance of success. And as long as you're doing that, then you're going in the right direction.
I guess that a good culture will hopefully encourage good processes, and then the good processes will hopefully encourage good results. But as there aren't any guarantees, as we said, all it is going to be is it's going to encourage them, and it's maybe increasing the chances. But the way I'd see it is the culture will hopefully improve the processes that you're putting in place.
The other thing to consider, David, as well, is what do people consider results? Because results isn't always a win or a loss or 3 points,
yeah,
or 10 points. You know, I look at the school programme that we run at Millfield, and whilst, you know, it's nice to win games of cricket and it's nice to have silverware and all of those things, often they're not the things that people remember. You know, if I said to somebody who won the T20 Cup in 2011 and 2012 at under 18 level in England, probably about four people would know the answer to that. But everybody knows that Chris Robshaw, the England rugby captain, was at Millfield. And that's a result. So Chris Robshaw coming through, and Vinopola coming through, and various others, Simon Joneses and Keyes Wetters and Kyron Powells and all of those people, they're the reasons why people sort of associate a result with Millfield, and I'm sure that that's the same down at Sam's school as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I bet as well there's going to be, in any bigger organisation, there's going to be people with different ideas of what success looks like. And it's being able to listen to all of those things and having a culture is the right word, a culture where someone can say what they think and not feel like it's been judged or they've been shouted down or their opinion doesn't matter just because it's different from a couple of other people.
Absolutely, but there has to be an overriding view and philosophy, I suppose, around what is a result. And certainly it's very clear at our school now, it's about giving people the best chance of success, supporting them on their way. And ultimately, it's about the people that come out the other end and end up achieving individual success, whether it be in an individual sport like a Pete Wilson, the Olympic gold medalist, or whether it's in team sports, as we see with a number of our guys playing in the England rugby side.
Let's wrap up this section with the yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no to, no matter how much more that the team want to say. I've got the questions, so let's start with number one. First question. Hard work will always overcome natural talent.
No.
Second question. 80% of all bowling velocity comes from shoulder-hip separation.
No.
No.
Third question. Concentration is a coachable skill.
Yes.
Yes.
At this time in the show, what we normally do is answer some questions that have been sent in by the listeners or perhaps readers to the Pitch Vision Academy website. And once we've answered those questions as best we can, we decide on a winner of a best question of the week. That's a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions into us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And that is exactly what Rohit has done. And Rohit says, is pace everything for fast bowlers in cricket nowadays? Can't we rely on a little less pace, but nice line, length and swing? Interesting point from the coach's point of view there. So what do we think?
I think we can rely on a little less pace with good line and length and good movement of the ball. As long as we've got some control with it. So I'd never say that it is all out about pace. Pace obviously has its benefits. It reduces decision-making time and it can intimidate people at the same time. So there are obvious benefits to pace, but I'd never say to anyone that they're not going to be able to perform because they're not able to produce a 90-mile-an-hour delivery. If you look at the way current things are going, in cricket, there's probably a few guys who are bowling a little bit quicker, and there are groups of bowlers who are bowling a little bit quicker. And some of the stats have shown that pace has been very, very effective. But similarly, if you go back to the Big Bash, there are quite a lot of guys who bowled some sort of low 80s stuff, which effectively would be classed as medium to fast medium bowling at that top level of the game, and with immense success. So. I guess we probably have to consider format a little bit, and it may be formats where the overriding pace does have more of an impact. Yet there'll be other formats where skill, as we would probably perceive it, not that pace isn't skill, but I think the skill with the ball, ability to move in both directions, ability to control it and adjust your pace as you're doing so and use your different positions on the crease and use the pitch to your advantage, would still be mighty effective. So my initial thoughts would be pace is really useful, and if you get someone who can bowl at whatever is deemed to be a fast pace at the level you're operating at, then it's going to be really useful, and if it can be harnessed and used in the right way, it's going to be very effective. But I do think there's always going to be room for someone who has that ability to manipulate the ball without necessarily the raw pace of a Mitchell Johnson or whoever else it may be.
This is quite a timely one for me as well. I was, as I mentioned before, I was at my new club's net, and there was a chap who was bowling, and he was very medium pace, and I said to him, you know, what how do you feel about bowling? And he said, yeah, it's great. You know, I've resigned myself to the fact I'm not going to be quick. I'm going to go for accuracy. I'm going to try and swing the ball a little bit and hopefully work the batsman over a little bit rather than just try and knock his head off, because that's never going to happen. And I said, yeah, but if you could have a little bit more pace, you wouldn't mind that, would you? Even if you're not bowling at 90 miles an hour, even if you can get it up by 5 miles an hour, that's going to benefit you a bit, isn't it? And he said, oh, definitely. I said, would you like to work on that? He said, absolutely. If you can get any more pace out of me, I'd be absolutely delighted. So I guess what I'm saying there, Gareth, is that whatever pace you're at, a little bit of extra pace is always going to be all right, isn't it?
Well, it is. But then I'm assuming that you're talking to somebody who is young enough to be able to do that and maybe has got the inclination to want to put the hard work in. And I think what we understand about fast bowling is that it is hard work, both on the journey to get more pace and also then to produce more pace on a on a consistent basis in matches. You know, the ability for guys like Mitchell Johnson and Stark and various others around the world and Dale Steyn to bowl fast is hard, isn't it? It's hard in the training, it's hard out on the pitch, and you've got to want to do that. And I would probably say that there's less want around the world per person to do that than there maybe was 15, 20 years ago. You know, it's hard yakka, as Simon Hughes once put it, and we need to consider that as well. Would everybody want extra pace? I don't think everybody would want extra pace because of the hard work, but also I think people are scared of doing that as well because of what they might lose. At the top end of a game, it's very, I said last week that generally what happens is that the game increases in pace. The ball spins quicker, it seams quicker, it swings quicker, and it goes through the air quicker, both from the bowler's hand and also off the bat as well. So it's really important that we have pace at the top end of a game. But as you go down the levels of a game, unless you're an aspiring quick bowler looking for the top end of a game in future years, then pace is probably less important than being able to hit good areas and swing the ball a little bit. So I think we're a little bit over-reliant on it in all of the different levels of a game. But at the top end of a game, then it's definitely beneficial to have that extra couple of miles per hour. That is for sure.
I guess really it's a matter of thinking to yourself, it's not necessarily an either or. You don't have to be either a wily medium pacer or a super fast quick bowler who's tearing in. You can bowl a little bit quicker if you want to put the work in, and you can put the work in to be more accurate and use more skill-based bowling with swing and seam and all the rest of it. So what it boils down to is an individual analysis and review of what you want to achieve and how much effort you want to put into achieving it. And that's when you come out with what you're capable of getting to do.
How much value can you add to what you're going to do? What's the reward at the end of the work that you want to do, and what's the workload that's going to be involved in reaching that reward? And Gareth mentioned before, not everyone has the time or the inclination to want to put that work in, and some people do. So it's weighing up those factors and thinking if you want to invest in that yourself or not.
Yeah, and so often with these things, there is that sort of... it's nice to put a dichotomy, isn't it? Oh, we've got a fast bowler, we've got a swing bowler. You know, these guys are... One guy does one thing, one guy does another thing. And you have to choose which one it is. But that's not necessarily always the case. You know, you can put in the effort to be somewhere on the scale of that thing, and it's not necessarily one or the other. You can possibly work within those ranges rather than just saying, today I'm a fast bowler, tomorrow I can't bowl fast, so therefore I'm going to be a swing bowler. Next question is from Ryan. And Ryan had a question previously on the show about spin bowling and field settings, and he's come up with another one. And he says, I'm interested to know your thoughts on field settings for spinners in one-day cricket and how to deal with the middle-over periods, as well as power plays and being able to attack but not go for too many runs. So bowling spin in the middle overs, it's a toughie. What do we think?
Well, it is a toughie, but also I think it's an opportunity as well. And I'm not sure whether anybody's really got to grips with this as yet. I see people very defensively. So a bowler comes on at first, and unless an opposition is three or four down for not very many, they won't bowl with a slip, or they won't have an attacking fielder when the spinner first comes on. And I think people are missing a trick. Generally, the spinner comes on after the quick bowlers or the medium pacers have been bowling. All of a sudden, you have this change in pace and a change in reaction off of the surface. And I think if there's a time to attack, it's right at the beginning of that spell before anybody has become accustomed, either in the middle or in watching from the sidelines, accustomed to what is happening out there. So my temptation is always to attack early with a spinner, unless probably I'm working with a leg spinner in certain conditions where I might be slightly more defensive. But say a finger spinner, a left arm finger spinner or an off spinner, I'd look to attack early and then adjust back from that what I see too often is people defend early and then try and claw it back by attacking a bit later, by which time the batter has got in and is knocking the ball around and doing it with ease. So my view on it is that I think people miss a trick. I don't think they attack early enough with spinners, because you can always come back from that plan instead of having to try and raise that plan when somebody's accustomed to the conditions. So to me, I'd always start with a slip unless the game situation dictated that I completely couldn't. And I've watched a number of games in this World Cup and thought, go on, be brave, right at the start of a spinner's spell. So that would be my first thing. I'd encourage people to be attacking. And then in terms of power plays, I think you've really got to say to yourself, where am I most comfortable being hit? Where can I most control being hit? And you may take into considerations boundary length. You may consider where you're more comfortable being hit as a person generally. You might look at the wind, which way it's blowing. So you could maybe use the wind in the face of a batter as an extra fielder. And effectively try and limit that. If they are going to go big, then they've got to hit a ball 10 rows over the top of a bloke back on the boundary, and you're going to make sure that they hit as many balls in that direction as you possibly can. And if they get it slightly wrong, then they're going to get a wicket. So to me, if I'm an off spinner bowling in one day cricket in a power play, I would go deep square leg, deep mid wicket, deep mid on and bowl arrow straight, changing my pace, bits and bobs, and make somebody go up over the top of mid-off or extra cover to try and get their boundary. You know, that would be my first point. If they were really good at that and not a slog sweeper, then I might bring up my deep mid-wicket and stick back my mid-off or stick back my deep cover, depending on how they're playing it. But I would take my strengths into consideration first, the conditions second, and then the batter at the other end third.
I think one thing I spoke about on Monday night, when I was working with some of our first team bowlers at Boroughs Cricket Club, actually, is we were saying that sometimes actually just don't be afraid of bowling wide, because a wide is one run. And if it's wide that you're bowling to a set field, then don't worry about it. Because if you try and commit to something which is going to give a batter opportunity, then that could go for fours, sixes, twos, etc. Whereas if you're bowling something which you feel, as Gareth said there, bowling straight to a leg side set field as an off spinner. If the ball goes down leg side for a wide three times in three overs, then it's three runs you've conceded. But you haven't put the ball in a position where they can go and score fours and sixes with ease, or twos and fours with ease. Anyway, so one of the things we talked about is when we're trying to dictate play, don't worry about bowling the occasional wide, as long as you're bowling to a plan which going to restrict greater things, as it were.
That was interesting, Gareth, what you said about attacking a little bit at the beginning. It puts a bit more pressure onto the bowler to get it right first time. I guess there's a certain type of person who would feel that pressure more than another type of person who feel like they want that extra protection until they find their rhythm. That's a very common thing that bowlers say, isn't it?
But I think it's a cop-out as well, that. I think that's something that we've ingrained as a coaching group, or as a cricket group. But that's almost a traditional wisdom, isn't it, that's been developed. Work your way into a spell. And I get that. But if I'm a batter facing a bowler, my most vulnerable time is going to be right at the start of their bowling, because I don't know anything about them, or I don't know how the ball's going to react off the pitch. I often feel that the horse is bolted before the positive change is made. And, you know, I'm not saying give them an easy boundary away by putting a slip in. You can still have a really sensible field and still have a slip, because we managed to do it in test match cricket on a regular basis. So I think that's a cop-out. That I would challenge that. I'm not saying that I would disagree with it or agree with it all the time, but I think it's a cop-out that we need to challenge.
Shane Warne used to speak about it quite a lot, didn't he? And I think maybe what he said has been misinterpreted slightly, because he talked about starting defensively and then bringing fielders in to create what looks like growing pressure on a batter as he got into his spell. And I think people misinterpret that sometimes, and people often start defensively for an over or two, and then they start to think about how they can start to attack more. Whereas actually what Shane Warne would do is he'd probably bowl one ball with a defensive field, maybe two balls, and then he'd start attacking straight away from there. And he wouldn't give them two overs to settle in. It would be straight away, I've seen something, right, let's be aggressive against this guy, let's put this guy under the pump. And he'd do it more, he wouldn't do it to settle in, he'd do it to pressurise the person, make them feel like they weren't as good as he thought they were initially by bringing in fielders after one ball or two balls. And that, was part of his mind games. And maybe that's something that required a level of skill as well, that maybe most people can't aspire to at the moment. But he would start defensively a lot of the time. He talked about that a lot, but it would be a matter of one or two balls before he was then putting the pressure on them.
But in a normal situation when Warnie bowled in one day cricket, and I don't mean, you know, overs 35 onwards when, you know, you're probably looking to defend at that point. But, you know, when he came on to bowl, maybe outside of a power play after the seamers had done their bit, how many balls, Sam, I hear what you're saying, but how many first balls of his first over would he have bowled without a slip?
It wouldn't, yeah, as I was saying, it wouldn't be the slip that he'd bring in. He'd start with a slip.
Yeah, exactly.
There'd be more pressure on the ones. He'd always have his wicket-taking option, wouldn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And now, he was obviously a brilliant bowler, and people listen to this go, yeah, but Shane Warne was the best leg spinner that we've ever seen. And they'd be right. You can't. But one of the things that made him great was the mindset that he had. It wasn't just, in fact, his technical skills went down as his career got longer, yet his strike rate stayed the same. And why did they? Because he was mentally sharp. And he knew that the batters would adjust to him the longer they play. So that's a given fact, isn't it? So he would always have a chance of getting a wicket in those first few overs. And how many times did he do it? We look at Swanee. You know, Swanee's ability to get a wicket in his first over was massive. If he didn't have attacking fielders or people that could take catches in that first over, then he was missing the opportunity to get a wicket. And I'm watching this World Cup and I'm seeing people go to slips and go to men on the drive or one man on the drive only when the opposition are four down when they bowl their first ball or five down, or if they've picked up a couple of wickets and then are trying to apply the pressure on number 7, 8 and 9. I think we're missing a trick.
The other question, of course, is what's the worst that can happen if you do have an attacking fielder and it doesn't pay off and you do, and someone does manage to thread the ball through the gap for a boundary, and he does it twice and you think, okay, well, that's not working, and then you change it. So
exactly.
What's it going to cost you? 8 runs at the outset? 12, and perhaps?
And as people are scoring 400 now in 50 overs, what is 8 runs? Let's be honest.
And it's worth it if he hits 2 fours and then nicks off. That's a good average, isn't it?
Correct.
We're nearly at the end of the show, but before we finally wrap things up, we're going to have another rant from Mark Garraway. This time, he's restricted to 60 seconds and he can't be interrupted. Gareth, over to you for this week's soapbox.
I'm going to talk about groundsmen this week. I'm very lucky. I've got great groundsmen here at Millfield who put on everything that we can want. But one of the things, and I'm talking about it because I can see one of them outside cutting strips on the square, actually, and we're in March, right at the beginning of March, and yet the aim is that we get some practice in before we break up for Easter out on grass, and it's fantastic that you can do that. But there are very few places that do this, and groundsmen are very protective. And I talked about traditional wisdom a minute ago about, you know, I've got to get my match pitches right and what have you. What we're doing here, right on the edge of a square, we're cutting out a pitch, which guys could be practicing on maybe in 2 weeks' time, maybe a week's time if the sun shines and we get reasonable weather here, and we can be outside. How many groundsmen and how many coaches are asking their groundsmen to do exactly the same in the Northern Hemisphere over the next few weeks? How many people will have their first knock on grass in their first game? Is that ideal preparation? My answer would be no on that. So let's have some conversations with groundsmen. We're not going to cut up the square. You can put a net up on the side to protect the square, and then you're just using the outfield. Who gives a monkeys if somebody gets their knee and digs up a divot? You can always replace that divot when you're doing some fielding. So get out there, get on grass early, and put your groundsmen under pressure.
Okay, that is the end of the show for this week. We're wrapping things up here, but before we finally get away, we just need to decide on a winner of this week's competition. Of course, The online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com goes to the best question of the week, and we had Ryan's question about bowling in the middle overs as a spinner, and we had Rohit's question about bowling fast or bowling with a nice line and length and swing. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I say it every week nowadays, but the questions are outstanding at the moment, so well done both of you. But this week I'm going to go for Ryan, because I got to do two soapboxes this week as a result of your question. So thank you for that, Ryan, and enjoy the course that you're going to select.
Congratulations, Ryan. You're getting quite the collection there. So if anyone else is listening and they feel like Ryan's getting a little bit too much pitch vision action, then please feel free to send your question in to us. Gareth, how would somebody do that?
Well, Ryan does, and other people can. Give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us a line on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. Our Twitter is at pitchvisionacad. You can send us an 140-character question or comment there. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can subscribe to this show every week by getting your favourite podcast app, doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy and clicking on that subscribe button, or tapping, depending on how old you are. And if you want to do it the old school way instead, then you can do so by going to pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link for all the details on how to download, stream, or subscribe to the RSS feed. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavis.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys.